When I tell people I'm preaching a series on Ecclesiastes, very often I hear, "Wow, I never heard of a series on that." I guess some of them might even wonder, "Where is that?" Well, this is the Ecclesiastes, and I found, I don't know why, they're not hearing much, because not much is being written. They don't have many sources for Ecclesiastes. I found maybe 4 or 5 sources. But my main source is my good old friend David Jeremiah. I was in seminary with him and then in grad school also. He did a great job with this on TV, and so I wrote and got his series. It's really great. I must confess that I am using his outlines. You might look at that and say, "Reb didn't write that." Well, maybe not. Some of the things I changed, but not very much. He has a great series there. So I'm using that, and I wanted to make sure you understood that. I hadn't said it yet, and we need to say that. So today we come to Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 16, from 3:16 to 4:16, and you have those in your bulletin. You have the notes, 2 pages, one on each side. Please follow along, and as we learn what the book of Ecclesiastes has for us to learn. We've already seen there's no real meaning to life apart from God. Whatever you see about life, and whenever what things come into your life, unless we see it through God's glasses, it doesn't make any sense. So we learned that much in the first one. And then we learned that there's a time and a season for everything. A time for everything under the sun, he said. And then we learned that God's program is good, God's purpose is clear, and his program is sometimes mysterious. We just don't understand all that God is doing. So today, he's going to bring us into a new area, and that is, he's going to help us make some observations, and we're going to recognize the things that he tells us, because they exist today as well. But they'll raise a question, and the question will be, how does a loving and righteous God allow these things to go on? In chapter 12, verse 11, he says, the words of the wise are like goads. You know what a goad is? Not a goat, a goad. It's a little, depending on what the animal you're working with. If it's an ox, it's a great big old thing around with a lot of pricks on it, and they stick the oxen with it, and he goes. He's probably talking here about something a little lighter than that you use with sheep. Little pin on the end of a stick, and you want him to go somewhere, you pick him, and he goes. Well, that's what a goad is. And he says that the words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are well-driven nails given by one shepherd. And I think that he thinks something different here. The nails are something that he's going to see from God. The wise man gives us some observations, but the answer comes from God. The well-driven nails. He's going to nail some things home to us if we'll just listen. So, Solomon's going to give us some goads, and then he's also going to give us the nails. I'll try to remember to point those out to you as we go. His first goad is the problem with faulty justice. The problem with faulty justice. He said, moreover, I saw, and you'll hear that saw, the word saw all through here. I saw, I saw, I saw. You'll find it in chapter 3, verse 16, verse 22, and in chapter 1, 7, and 15, I saw. So he's observing things. He's seeing the things that are going on around him and in his life. So he says, moreover, I saw, notice that phrase, under the sun. I saw under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. And then he said some things. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. And I said in my heart concerning the conditions of the sons of men, God tests them, and that they may see that they themselves are like animals, and so forth. So he's saying, I saw. What Solomon saw was that wickedness is in the place of judgment, and iniquity is in the place, had been replaced by righteousness. Now, there's not a lot of difference, I think, in this between judgment and righteousness. It's the kind of a parallelism. You say it one way for to get the point across, and then you say it another way to emphasize it. And so he's saying that there is no justice in the place where justice ought to be. Wickedness is there. And Solomon saw this in these injustices right in the least place. You know, you don't want to see in the courts, in the place where people mete out justice, wickedness is there. And it's shot through with wickedness. And Solomon saw that. And just like in his day, so in our day as well. People are innocent and they're found guilty. People are guilty and they're found innocent. The rich can grease the palm and oil the machinery of justice to go their way. And that's what Solomon says. I saw that, and that's terrible. That's one of the things. That's the goad that he saw. Then he gives us a few nails. Here are some nails that God brings to us. This is what Solomon said, verses 17 to 22. He says, judgment is coming. In 3:17, he says, judgment is coming. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, both. And there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. God is going to judge, he says. The judgment is not necessarily eternal. It will be eternal, but there's other judgment that comes. Judgment that's temporal, right here and right now. God's going to do it, but it's going to be in his time. See? There's a time for every purpose and for every work. See? So don't get confused and say, well, if God didn't do the punishment today, he's not going to do it. No. He's going to judge. God will judge, and he'll do it in his own time. You see, they think they got away with it. Oh, we did this and we got away with it. We made this much money and we stepped on these poor old people. No, they didn't get away with it. For now, maybe. But eventually, God's going to judge them. He's going to judge them here and now, or he's going to judge them then and there, but they're going to be judged. They'll pay for it. So judgment is coming. Then he says in verses 18 to 21, death is certain. Death is inevitable. Do you know what the odds are that you might not die? You ever think of it? How many people do you think have lived? 10 billion? 15 billion people have lived so far? How many have not died? Well, besides the ones who are going to die. But how many people who are past the age of 100 have not died? How many do you know who did not die in that 15 billion? Two. I can name you two, and you can too. Yeah. Enoch, he walked with God, and he was not. God took him. Didn't die. Elijah, remember Elijah, caught up in a chariot of fire? Two people. So your odds are 7.5 billion to 1. That's worse than the lottery. You're no chance. Yeah. 7.5 billion to 1, you're going to get out of here without dying, except, of course, for the rapture. Maybe you'll go with me in the rapture. But I'm waiting for that. You wonder how I'm living this long? I'm waiting for the rapture. I'm not going to go. But it's certain that a person's going to die. The odds are too great to say otherwise. Then he talks about the animals. He said, men are like animals. 18b. And he's talking here about the bodies. The critics love this. The critics say, see, even your Bible says that the men die, they go in the grave. Animals die, they go in the grave, and there's no difference between them. And so, don't worry about anything hereafter. God is not doing any of that. God is not going to have, there's not going to be any hereafter, since there's no God. All of that is what they're trying to get out of this one verse. Read the whole thing. What's the way we learn here? How we interpret? Context. Context. That's it. We have to learn by context. He says that humans and animals both die. That's true. You ever have a dog that lived to be 100? I found out the other day that in dog years, I'm 11 years old. If I were a dog, I'd be 11 years old. But they die. I see a cat run around the neighborhood now, orange cat. We had a cat like that. We called him Buster when I was about 5 or 6 years old. I don't think it's the same cat. Yeah. He died. And a lot of people who were around that cat died as well. That's what happens. They both die. And verse 20 says they both turned to dust. You know, that great body you got there, give it a few years, dust. Because you came from dust and you're going back to dust. He's talking about the bodies, not talking about your spirit. Because look at the next verse. Men are unlike animals in their spirits, because the animal spirit, man's spirit goes upward, and animal spirit goes downward, he says. Remember what he says in verse 20? Verse 21, for who knows the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and the spirit of the animal, which goes downward. See? So there's a difference between animals and humans. Critics take that, you know. Now, there's a chart in the back, by the way, if you want to know where people go when they die. We have I put some charts on the credenza back in the foyer. Help yourself. They'll probably, I'll pick up a four or five there. Take one. Look at it. Look up the scriptures. It may help you to understand that. That's where the spirit goes upward, he says. And then in verse 22, he says, life continues. Rejoice in your works. Life goes on. Don't be so concerned about all the oppression and so forth. Rejoice in your works. And I think he means not only your work for the Lord. I think he means everything you do. Rejoice in your work. You don't like your work? Rejoice. Try rejoicing in it. You'll love it. Now, when you go to work, be the best whatever you are that that company has ever seen. You know, be the best bookkeeper. Be the best ditch digger or whatever. Be the best one in your group, because you can rejoice in your work if you do that. And then, in the meantime, leave the evil to God. Life continues. And so when you have all these problems come on you, oh, my, what are we going to do? You're going to live. That's what's going to happen. You're going to keep on living. So keep on living. Rejoice in what you do. Enjoy your day. And enjoy your evenings. Leave it to God. Here's a little verse I like. God holds the key to all unknown, and I am glad. If others held the key, should hold the key, or if he trusted it to me, I'd be sad. I cannot read his future plans, but this I know. I have the smiling of his face and all the refuge of his grace while here below. That's what we need to do. Life goes on. Keep on going. Then, besides faulty justice, he sees fierce oppression. The living, he says, have no comfort. In chapter 4, at verse 1, I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun, and look, the tears of the oppressed, for they have no comforter. You've been there. You've been oppressed. Things have happened, whether it's from other people or from circumstances that come into you. You're oppressed. And you have tears. And there's nobody there to comfort, he says. And then the power of everything is with the oppressor. The oppressor comes and he has all kinds of power. He does as he pleases. On the side of the oppressors there is power, but they have no comforter. Therefore, I praise the dead who are already dead. What? I praise the dead who are already dead. The psalmist has a little thing to say about this. Psalm 73. In verses 2 and 3, he says this. As for me, my feet were almost stumbled. My steps had almost slipped. For I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. When I thought how to understand this, it was too painful for me. That's what Psalmist Asaph has to say. Yeah, it's there. The living have no comfort. He says, the dead are happier. The dead are happier than the living. How so? He said, I praise the dead. because they're already dead. You know, I think sometimes about, I hear something on the news, global warming. Florida's going to be underwater by 3,000. Oh, me, what am I going to do? I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Nothing. Why? Because I'll be dead. See, I praise the dead. I praise the fact that I'm going to be gone with that. Either that'll be here or there, but I'll be dead. It won't matter to me. Sounds like a fellow I heard was getting a lecture, listening to a lecture, and about half asleep, and the guy said, this whole country is going to be devastated within the next 20 million years. And the guy said, what? He just heard that last part. What did you say? I said, 20 million years. He said, whew, I thought you said 20,000. A lot of difference that makes. The dead, he'll be dead by then. See? So the dead are happier than the living. But then he says, the unborn is happier than they are. The unborn, they haven't experienced any of this oppression. Job was like that. Job said he lost his camels, remember, lost all of his sheep, lost all of his donkeys, even his children. Lost everything but his wife. He probably wishes he had lost her part of the time, you know, because she wasn't much help. He said in chapter 3, he says, why was I born? Or having been born, why did I not die immediately? See? Why? Well, because it's a problem. Now, the psalmist had that problem, remember? He said, until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I understood therein. What was he doing? He was over here. He thought, all the world is revolving around me. And there's some problems here. Why are there problems? Because everything's supposed to be nice for me. Because I am the center of the universe. No. It's like the scientists who saw the planets before when they thought that the Earth was the center of the universe. They saw these planets going back and forth. They were going all kinds of crazy. That's why they named them planets. The word planet means wanderer. They called them wanderers. There's nothing more online on time than those planets. But they didn't think so. Why? They had the wrong impression. See? They thought, we're the center of the universe. Those things are going crazy. But then he says, when I got into the sanctuary of the Lord, when I got God's perspective, if they could pick up their telescope and go over to the sun, the real center of the universe, they'd say, oh, yeah, everything's going fine. See? And that's what happened to Asaph. He was over there thinking about how everything went wrong with him. But when he got over here, he got God's perspective. I went into the sanctuary of the Lord. Then I understood their end. See? But verse 28, he says, but it's good for me to draw near to God. I have put my trust in the Lord God that I may declare your works. See? So the unborn are still happier than the dead, even, and certainly better than the living. But God had the answer. The faulty justice, the fierce oppression, and then the problem of financial reality. Ooh. Financial rivalry, excuse me. Both hands are full. That's one way. Some people in financial area, they have both hands full, and they were grasping for more. Grab, 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 grab. And they do it not because they need it. They have plenty. Why do they drive, and I don't think I'm hitting anybody here, why do they drive a $60,000 car instead of a $20,000 car? Why? Well, it's to make the neighbor jealous. I saw, for all the toil and every skillful work of a man, this is 4:4, he did it because that work of the man is the envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping of the wind. He did it so the neighbor would watch him. The neighbor would look at him and say, oh my, what a nice car, a big car, $60,000 car. And the neighbor is jealous. Have you seen that commercial where the guy has a Mazda and his neighbor has just bought a Toyota, and he's standing there with his door opener, his garage door opener, and he says, why did you get that car there? Oh, better deal, had this and this and this. And he's pushing, trying to get the door to go down on his Toyota, kind of hiding a little bit. And the other guy says, you got a Toyota? I got a Mazda. What? the envy of the neighbor. See? And that's the way it is. So all the grasping, holding with hands, that's for the envy of others. Well, they remind me of the snail. A snail bought a car. And he said, he paid for it and left it there. Said, now, what I'd like for you to do is put a big red S on each side of the car. And he came back, and the car was ready. It had a big red S on it. And they said, wait a minute. Why did you want a big red S on your car? He said, so that when I drive down the street, they'll say, look at that S car go. He wanted everybody to see it. Ask your neighbor, Hitler. Both hands full. Both hands empty. In verse 5, the fool folds his hands. Everything's all against him. Just fold your hands. He consumes his own flesh. So he's a dropout. Remember the dropouts of the 60s? Not you, but some people did. Back in the 60s, they dropped out and they had the VW van. I know somebody had a VW van not too long ago. Had a VW van, and they were running around with flowers in their hair and not doing a thing, dropping out. See? And he says, the fool does that. The fool says, oh, no use to do it. I'll just sit around here and let everybody out. I'll work for money. Say, I got a job for you. Oh, no, not that. Give me money. Well, that's the dropping out part. Both hands empty, nothing. Then he says in verse 6, have one handful. Better a handful, singular, handful with quietness, than both hands full, together with toil and grasping for the wind. So, better to have one handful. In other words, he's saying, get some balance in your life. Don't work, but I'm just telling Melody today, we got to stop doing that. Work, and grasp the money, and we're not doing that, and get it all together. For what? See? No. And don't drop out. Don't leave everything to go and consume your own flesh. No. Get a balance in your life. Proverbs 16:18 says, pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Proverbs 16:8. Better a little with righteousness than vast revenues without justice. And then Proverbs 30, really 7 through 9. Two things I request of you. Deprive me not before I die. Remove falsehood and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food allotted to me, lest I be full and deny you, or lest I say, and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of the Lord. See? And Paul sums it all up in these few words. Godliness with contentment is great gain. Have all what you need, but then be content with what you have. Faulty justice, fierce oppression, financial rivalry. Now, fractured relationships. He's going to have two things here. Riches over relationships, and relationships over riches. So, riches over relationships, he starts out with, verses 7 and 8. Then I returned and saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone, without companion. He is neither, without companion. He has neither son nor brother. Yet there is no end of all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. He never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? So he's alone. He doesn't have a brother or a son. He's either alienated or ignored his family as he got his riches together. Has no friends to share it with. Now he has no one. Sound like anybody around Christmas time? Not your Aunt George, Uncle George. Scrooge, remember Dickens' Christmas Carol? He had all kinds of money, but he was so wrapped up in himself that he couldn't do anything else. So his riches were over his relationships. He worked hard. He was rich. He got whatever he was after. He got the wealth. And that's all he had. He was not content with his wealth. He didn't need to work. He had plenty. He just kept on working. Work. And he never asked, Why am I doing this? For whom am I doing it? I'm depriving myself of good and nothing's there. That's riches over relationship. Then he said, talks about relationship over riches, 9 through 12. He says, this is also vanity and great misfortune. Two are better than one, because they have good reward for their labor. If they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken. What's he saying? Well, he's saying that relationships are better than riches. Two are better than one for walking. That's what he's saying. Walking alone. If you walk and you fall down, well, how are you going to get up? If you have two walking, that's great. You know, you need two. Better for working. Two alone, two people can get more done than they can do it separately. You'd think, well, he does this much work. He does this much work. Put them together, be twice as much. No, I think not. I think that there'd be more there, because there are certain things that you can't do by yourself. The whole is greater than the sum of the two parts, because as they work together, they're working better, working more efficiently, and so forth. And so they do more. Reminds me of when I was a little kid. My father worked on the railroad, section hand, and they used to pull these wooden ties. Remember the wooden ties are under the rails. They pull them out because they were bad, throw them off to the side, and my father would have them stacked up, and he would go get them. And we'd have them for firewood. Bad thing in those days. And so on a Saturday morning, he'd say, okay, boys, Egghead and me, here's a long old saw. The thing looked like a mile long, probably 5 or 6 feet. No way one person could do that by himself. You know? So we got there, and he would pull, I would pull. He'd pull. That's all it is. That's the way we've been working together. We had to do the job. So two is better for working. Then he says two are better for walking. They accompany each other. They encourage one another. You ever have two people get together and say, I think I want to walk for my health. And somebody says, oh yeah, I want to too. And the more ambitious one says, okay, I'll be at your house tomorrow morning, 6 o'clock. Be ready. I'll just whistle and you'll come out. Well, that works for a while. But it's better walking if you walk together, you know. Encourage one another. That's what he's saying. Walking for your health. So it's better for working, better for walking, better for warmth. Two can lie down together and keep warm. Yeah. Now, keep that in context. Don't forget the context. This is for marriage, if you're going to lie down together. But I think in the context there, he's talking about people who are they're walking along over the mountains or wherever, and maybe a lot of people would be together. They'd stop at an inn or whatever, and maybe they would get their blankets together, and they all huddle together, and the warmth. It's like the March of the Penguins, you know, get together for warmth. So that's what he's saying. Be warm. Keep it together and be warm. Two are better also for watching. He says if one person is attacked, he may lose. But if you have two, then if somebody attacks, then the two of you can beat him. Or even three. A threefold cord is hard to break, is what he's saying. So they can protect each other. So there's faulty justice, fierce opposition, financial rivalry, fractured relationship, and then fickle popularity. You know, popularity is fickle. In the United Kingdom, there were three kings only, Saul, David, and Solomon, and they all had 40-year reigns. And I think that this passage is probably talking about that. There are a lot of things that are discussed. Oh, it could be this, could be that. It sounds to me like he's talking about his predecessors in the kingship there in Israel. He talks about an old and foolish king. In verse 13, he says, better a poor and wise youth than an old foolish king who will be admonished no more. Who in the world is the old foolish king? Sounds like Saul to me. See? He was the pretty boy. He was head and shoulders above everybody else in Israel. And the people said, oh, we want him for our king. And so they got it. And Samuel couldn't understand that. He prayed, Lord, what's happening? And he said, they haven't rejected you. They rejected me. They rejected God for a man head and shoulders above. And he started out very, very popular, but ended with nothing. You know? God told him, go and kill Amalek and everything that's part of him. He didn't do it. Didn't do it right. And Samuel came along, was supposed to come for a sacrifice, and King Saul waited and waited. Where is he coming? He's supposed to be here to have a sacrifice. He didn't come. And so Saul went in there and made the sacrifice himself. And boy, God didn't like that, because you can't have a king priest in the Old Testament. Who's the only king priest? Jesus Christ is the only king priest. He broke a picture there. And so God said to him, when Samuel finally came, he said, oh, I did this because you didn't come. He said, you have erred. God's going to get you for that. Words to that effect. And when he left, Samuel decided, I'm going to leave. You're done. God's done with you. And so as Samuel left, he reached out, oh, Lord, and he pulled Samuel's garment and tore it. And God says, God has taken the kingdom from you. It won't last. You'll be king as long as you're alive, but your son Jonathan will not follow you. The kingdom is gone. That was it. That's the way he was. He didn't talk with God. He talked with the witch of Endor. You know, that's the way he was. That's the old and foolish king, I believe. The wise youth from poverty is in verse 14. For he comes out of prison to be king, although he was poor in his kingdom. Now, the coming out of prison sounds like Joseph, and people get into that too. But the one born poor in his kingdom, in Saul's kingdom, I think is David. And David, remember, the maidens were singing, Saul has slain his thousands, David has slain his tens of thousands. Wow, that's good for David, but not so hot for Saul, you know. But that was David really going great guns there. And then there was a second youth, he says. In verse 15, he says, and I saw all the living who walk under the sun, and there was a second youth who stands in his place. That second youth I take to be Solomon. So Saul, David, and Solomon. Boy, what a king. He built the temple. And you read sometimes all the things that he did there. And all the animals that they sacrificed, that was a tremendous thing. And it took him a lot of years to build it. Then he built a palace for the king, and he expanded the kingdom. The kingdom under Solomon was the largest it ever was. And he had all kinds of people under tribute, a great kingdom. It's called the Golden Age of Israel. And then the people came from all over the world to see the kingdom and to hear his wisdom. They came from the Queen of Sheba came, remember? All of that. And then he begins a downward thing. He married foreign wives, and he worshiped their gods. And this same one who's writing this Ecclesiastes is the one who's saying, that this popularity slips, it's gone. They said people did not rejoice over him. People forget. Tonight is Oscar night. Who won last year? Huh? Don't tell anybody if you know. You'll ruin my illustration. But it's fleeting. Right? It goes away. Popularity is fickle. So we've seen faulty justice, fierce opposition, financial rivalry, fractured relationships, fickle popularity. But his advice is, don't look at the circumstances. God is the only one that you can have any certainty with. Look to God. Ignore your circumstances. Look to God. Father, thank you that you have given us this great book for to see ourselves, to hold a mirror up to us and say, believe in God, trust and obey. We thank you for it in our Savior's name. Amen.